Welcome to Parallel Lines, and yeah, just to remind you, I'm Anna Jane Hunter, and my co-host
Tony Miles.
Really pleased to have you here, and even more pleased to welcome our very special guest, as pre-trailed on a previous episode, my very, very dear friend, Mr. Ollie Glover, now Member of Parliament for Didcot and Wantage. Ollie was previously a colleague of mine in the rail industry, and so really pleased to have him here to give us what is going to be a bit of a special episode, I think, where we're going to talk, as usual, loads of railways, of course, but with some of that kind of insight into somebody's political kind of angle on this. And not too deep, don't worry. We never go too deep on this stuff, do we?
We don't. And before we go to Ollie for the whole conversation, we're recording this in Liverpool again. This morning, I happened to be filming the Metro Mayor, Steve Rotherham, and I asked him a couple of questions about how he's feeling with the new government and a new attitude to railways.
So you're very keen now that the government devolves the authority to spend and to make decisions locally. What would that mean if you could get sort of devolved control of your budgets?
Well, it'd mean that we get a single pot settlement whereby it'll be the local people here in the Liverpool City region that will decide on what the priorities for that spend would look like. And public transport is massive for us, but it might be that people would prefer more housing or council housing or whatever that might be. But it'll be us rather than mandarins in Whitehall and Westminster, politicians deciding what local people need here. So I think any decision that's devolved down to a local level is better.
And GBR is on the way. Nobody's quite sure exactly what it's going to be like, and it's probably going to take a bit of time to actually undo things and unpick things. But what do you think that's going to mean as a change for passengers and for the railways as a whole?
We've been meeting with Network Rail and with the other people who are involved in what is, at this moment in time, a very fragmented system. Anything that pulls together all of those disparate parts to make it more coherent, to make it better for passengers, there has to be something surely that everybody would support. It's going to be interesting in the next few months because I'm sure there'll be lots of lobbying at a parliamentary level. But I've got every confidence in our new Secretary of State that she'll do what's right for passengers.
So, Ollie, you're not in Liverpool. You're on Teams. And as I said, newly Member of Parliament. You were previously in the rail industry, which is sometimes described as an unwieldy, big, kind of slow to change, lots of governance, lots of white middle-aged men, lots of kind of grumpy people. You left that to go to Parliament, which some might say is quite similar. So what brought that about then?
Well, I think there's lots of things, really. I mean, the first answer I'd give is to do with the rail industry. And I think my experience of working in the rail industry and predominantly Network Rail and train operating companies, but a little bit in other organisations as well, it's very hard to change anything within the rail industry. A lot of the fundamentals are not decided by managing directors of train operating companies or the chief executive of Network Rail. They're decided by central government and civil service. And there's lots that I think that's true in lots of other aspects of society. We're the most centralised country in the Western world. So much is just decided from London and from Westminster. And I think you kind of have to be there to have a voice and to try and shape things for the better. But it's also about helping people and really making a difference, because that is the key role of an MP, actually, is to help your constituents. And the range of correspondence and things I've been asked to help with is quite extraordinary.
Yeah, I can imagine. And I mean, well done. And, you know, I've communicated with you directly about this. Well done for getting your maiden speech in. Well done for getting on your feet straight away about the Railways Act. And, you know, I know you feel passionately about not just the railway, but public transport in general. But you're not just there to talk about transport, are you? Just talk us through briefly some of the issues that you've already kind of been out and about and seeing in the past few weeks.
You mean within the constituency?
Yeah, because it's fascinating. Just in the constituency, because it's fascinating, the breadth, isn't it, of what you've seen already, even.
Yeah, so the big issues within the constituency, I mean, the thing that's dominated the, well, we don't have a post bag anymore.
Metaphorical postbox.
The email inbox. So there's a landfill site about a few miles northwest of Didcot, which has been there for a long time, and sort of housing sort of gradually gets closer to it. And for the last few months, it's particularly since April, it's been producing a really, really strong smell, which has been driving people insane. So I've been doing a lot of work with the operator of that site, with the Environment Agency, to say, well, come on, what's causing this? What's your plan to sort it out? And then to try and keep residents informed. I mean, hopefully they think it's the worst of it is now over in terms of the problem that they had. we have the same problems here that we do everywhere else in terms of, you know, no one can get a GP appointment or they really struggle to do so. And we've got this new development in Didcot, which is supposed to have had a GP surgery when it was first built 10 years ago. It still doesn't. So I've been meeting people with that, you know, pushing them to be specific about what the next steps are and how we're going to communicate with residents. And we have some of our own transport challenges here. So we're keen to have a new station in this place called Grove near Wantage. This is between Didcot and Swindon. Mm-hmm. That's a 25-mile stretch of the Great Western Main Line where there are no stations. The communities along that route have seen huge housing growth. So it means a lot of people have to drive or use the bus to get to Didcot or Swindon, which doesn't really work very well. And like everywhere else, you know, people want to see more buses more often, and people also would like to be able to walk and cycle, because at the moment not many people do, because it's not very pleasant and people don't feel it's very safe.
So there's some stuff in there which I think you can totally help with, being an MP who's had a career in transport previously, because a lot of what we talk about on Parallel Lines and in the conversations I have is about things like long-term planning. And, you know, you mentioned the Western Main Line there and how, you know, obviously there were upgrades that happened years ago, but did they really look further enough into the future? Did they link up with the housing developments that you just mentioned there? Were they even thinking about active travel when they, you know, did the Main Line upgrades? So I guess that's the kind of thing you're going to want to get involved in, isn't it? And kind of explain to people who maybe don't see how all those things fit together. You know what I mean? It's a system, isn't it?
Yes. We've hit on the absolute nub of the issue and something we do particularly badly here, which is planning in the widest sense of the word. Now, when I say planning, I mean specifically in terms of this whole issue of how we accommodate population growth and population change. Mm. And in my view, the fundamental problem with how we do it here is that there's sort of central government preoccupation with housing numbers and housing targets, and they don't have the same preoccupation with making sure that all of the facilities, amenities and services that support those housing numbers happen. And that is a real political problem, because it leads people to resent new houses.
Yeah.
Not necessarily because they're against them per se, because sometimes you get people who live in the new house themselves who are opposed to more. It's because they don't have faith in the system. They see those new houses being built near them. They have no confidence that the GP capacity will improve to meet them, or that there'll be improvements to the transport system, or that the schools will be planned ahead. And that does relate to the wider rail thing, because you get all of these sort of targets and objectives, but they're all very much set in isolation. And I think probably the key thing for rail in this area is there's been lots of good ideas and good intentions, but a lot of them have not been seen through. So, for example, Great Western Mainline electrification was supposed to have gone to Bristol, supposed to have gone to Oxford. It still hasn't, because the costs went up. You know, on one level, perhaps not surprisingly, because we hadn't done any really for 20 years on a big scale. And, you know, we're supposed to have this new fleet of shiny new intercity trains. You know, half of that fleet was going to be electric only. Now they're bi-mode. And now a lot of them are running around as five cars, even to places like Swansea quite often, because they've had to be diverted to the West Country because the need for new rolling stock there has not been made. So you start to see how all of these individual decisions, because they don't take account of the effect on other things, really start to let the passenger or the customer, depending on what word you want to use, down.
Yeah, and ultimately the taxpayer at the end of the day, isn't it? Because it's where it's coming from, isn't it, for all those things. So, yeah, a bit joined up thinking.
I've quoted this before, but many years ago, the Professor of Railway History at the University of York, Professor Colin Duval, who was still professoring, I must catch up with him, said one of the things was that we invented the passenger railway in the UK, and since then we never actually wrote down what it's for. So we've lurched on for nearly 200 years with this thing. We can't do an end-of-the-year review. Did it do what it's supposed to do? Because we've never said what it's supposed to do. So we don't automatically plan for rail to serve a new town or a new housing development or whatever. And there's no tick box that we say, oh, we failed to do that bit of the project, because it's never there in the first place. So one of the great things, here's a mission for you in the next 4.5 years or so, is could we write down what the railways are for?
I completely agree with that, and I sort of alluded to that in the speech I made in Parliament about the passenger services bill about nationalising the train operators. That's something that we never have any clarity on, is what do we actually want, not just the railway, but our transport system as a whole to achieve?
Yeah.
What is the point of it? And I don't think successive governments have properly wrestled with that question. So instead, you get these very tactical considerations. So, for example, following the pandemic, it was all about, right, passenger numbers are down, revenue's down, so that means we've got to cut cost. And then the short-term objective became cutting costs. But they did it in a way that wasn't very strategic. They didn't say, well, this is my impression from the outside, right? I was not someone at director level. I can only say how it seemed to me. What would have been a good way to go about that would have been for the Department for Transport and Treasury to say, right, rail industry, we want to get you around the table. We want to save X percent in annual operating costs. Now you go away and work out some options for how to do it that you think would work and would maintain some of our other objectives in terms of safety, customer satisfaction, capacity, whatever. It seems to me they didn't do that. And instead, it was this very sort of tactical, short-term approach of saying, well, this fleet lease is up for renewal. Can we save some money by not renewing the lease? Oh, yes, we can. So let's do it without thinking that through as to what the consequences of that. So yes, that's what we really need to spend some time doing. And I hope the new government will, because so far they haven't, from what I can see, is what do we actually want our transport system to achieve? And then let's set some objectives and measures around that and let people get on with it without the micromanagement and the interference.
From what you understand, are you going to be able to get involved in those kind of conversations? You know, how far along is the government thinking? We obviously saw them publish their high-level strategy. There's, as usual, not a lot of detail behind that that we've seen, but will you get to further debate it in the detail? Is it still there to be formed? You know, how open are they to input from what is a really big Liberal Democrat party now? You know, there's 70-odd of you. They're going to listen, aren't they, to you and other voices in the room, I'd hope?
I think they will. I think it remains to be seen, because yes, we do have our highest ever number of Liberal Democrat MPs, 72 of us, but Labour has, well, I would say 411, they've kicked seven out, so 404. So, you know, so in that sense, we are very small in comparison, and they don't have to listen to us because they have an enormous majority, and that's part of the problem with our political system, which tends to deliver governments with huge majorities, and then you just get one set of ideas. I very much hope that they will want to listen and engage with other ideas, if any of them will be listening to this, I very strongly encourage them to do that, because, you know, this, with Liberal Democrats, the joke that's sometimes been made historically is the amount of policy making detail we do is in inverse relationship to the amount of power we have to implement it. and that continues to be the case. We've got huge policy working groups and loads of very clever, engaged members, and we have very democratic policy making at our conference. In terms of how to influence it, well, there's the passenger services bill is now going through what we call third reading. Now, I don't, you probably, one of you may probably know more about this than I do, because I'm still learning. But this is where it's going to go through the committee stage, which is looking at a lot of the detail of it and the opportunity for scrutiny and challenge. And I will certainly want to get involved with that alongside our transport spokespeople in the Commons and the House of Lords. And then the government is planning to bring a much bigger bit of legislation later on. I'm not sure exactly when, maybe early next year. And that will be about the creation of Great British Railways and some stuff about the wider structure of the rail industry. And hopefully that will be the time to really influence that thinking. But it can't just be about rail in isolation. It's got to be about the economy and the transport system, because the relationship and interfaces between rail and bus are really important, because that is one of the key barriers to people using railway, that the perceived or actual inconvenience of the metaphorical last mile, because you don't have that in a car, your car goes from where you start your journey to where you end it, and also the interfaces with active travel, walking and cycling. I was very pleased to see a very encouraging article in The Guardian about what Louise Hague's been saying about walking and cycling, that they really want to put a lot of money behind it. I'm a little bit sceptical, just because so many governments have said that. But, you know, given that over more than half of car journeys are made for under 5 miles, there is a huge role to be had for walking and cycling. And again, how rail interacts with that is going to be really important for realising the potential that rail has for unlocking those other benefits.
I totally agree. And you're very modest and correct to say that, of course, Labour has 404 MPs. They don't have to listen to you. But I would hope I'm not being too disrespectful to any of those 404 very competent people to say that surely voices who have some form of experience and knowledge behind them around the subject area they're talking about have got to be worth, you know, more than one person who just has an opinion, which is why I hope they do listen to people who've brought something to the house, you know, with them from somewhere, be that industry, you know, or whatever. And your CV would hopefully be one that they'd respect, you know, with the knowledge that you've brought with you, because not everyone's got that insight that you've got. So I'll certainly be banging the drum saying, please, please include people who actually know what they're talking about, because so often there's people who just, they're very passionate about stuff, but they don't actually know what they're talking about. And this devolution thing bothers me as well, with the whole system. I get that Rotherham's bothered about Liverpool. Of course he is. I live in Liverpool and I love the transport system here. It's actually really great. It's the best I've experienced outside of London. And often I think people in Liverpool don't know how lucky they are. And I've actually said this to Steve directly, so I can repeat it on the podcast. The buses are brilliant here. Merseyrail's excellent. It's not perfect, but it's pretty good. But if you don't then join that up with the wider system, and like you just said there, Ollie, some of the more detailed things around walking and cycling, if you don't then finish off the job to people's doors, then you're still missing a trick, aren't you? And if you just let everyone go off and do their own thing because you've devolved it all, I think we might not get the best solution. We need this whole system thinking and people who understand how all the pieces of the jigsaw fit together. You know what I mean? It's a big, old, complex jigsaw.
It is. And I think we also don't need to reinvent the wheel, to use that silly expression. We can learn from places where that works. And I think we should follow the evidence. You know, we do too much eulogising about European countries' transport in this country, but sometimes it is justified. And if there were two examples, two countries that are relevant to what we're discussing, that I'd encourage the government and policymakers to really look at, it's firstly the Netherlands for active travel, and secondly Switzerland for the wider integration thing. So the Netherlands, I have been there, went there on a cycling study tour in 2008. I might get to go on another one. Don't worry, I'll be paying for all of it. Won't be on the taxpayer, because I have joined the all-party parliamentary group for walking and cycling, because I think it's so important. But in the Netherlands, you can cycle everywhere without coming into conflict or facing a nasty junction.
Yeah.
It's designed around that. And the reason why they get, you know, cycling shares of 30, 40, 50, 60% in most of their towns and cities is not because it's flat, which so many people love to say, because, you know, if that were the case, King's Lynn would be the cycling capital of the UK. It definitely isn't, by the way. They do it because it's a consistent network. You know that wherever you go in that country, you're going to get the same. Sometimes it is on road, but those are on roads where there's a 20 mile an hour speed limit, where the road has been redesigned so that cars are a guest and they can't go too fast. And where the road speed is higher than that, then it is segregated. It's well surfaced. Cyclists have priority in most junction situations. Mm-hmm. At complex junctions, they have separate traffic light phases for bikes. Whereas in London, you know, there is some good infrastructure's gone in London, but a lot of the time the traffic light phasing is just terrible, and you end up, by using the cycle path, you end up having to wait twice as long to get through the junction than if you stayed on the road. And then you get people saying, oh, why don't cyclists use a cycle path? Or, I mean, I'd much rather be doing so, but only if it isn't rubbish. So that's what we can learn from the Netherlands, and how they go about integrating that with the rail network. Seriously impressive. You know, they've got cycle parking facilities at some stations for thousands of bikes. You know, and they charge you to take a bike on a train in the Netherlands, which we don't hear. There's a €7 flat fee, which might sound counterintuitive that I'm advocating for that, but again, they make it easy to hire at either end, so you don't need to take it on the train so much. That's why I often take my bicycle on the train, is because, you know, there is unlikely to be something at the other end.
At the other end, yeah. Do they have more space on the trains, Ollie? Because that's a problem I see quite often with, it's all very well taking your bike, but, you know, there's such limited space for a bike on a train, booked or otherwise, that there just isn't much physical space.
To be honest, Netherlands specifically, I couldn't really tell you, because it's been a while since I've been there needing to take a bike on a train. But in general in Europe, I think that is something they're better than us at. Not so much on high-speed trains, because until recently, bikes have been banned on high-speed trains in most European countries. That's starting to change now with the new generation of German high-speed trains. But apart from that, where they've been procuring new rolling stock, what they're very good at doing is allocating, say, half a coach to a sort of shared use area, which has potentially got space for 24 bikes, goodness knows how many push chairs, whatever else you want to put in there. So it's a flexible space, rather than, you know, on our new Class 80X intercity trains, these terrible little closets where you're supposed to somehow fit two bikes in. And a lot of the time people put luggage and push chairs in there. And I don't blame people for doing that, because there isn't the space for the luggage and push chairs anywhere else. I mean, who knew that, you know, you'd need space for luggage on long distance intercity trains going from to Edinburgh. I mean, who could have anticipated that?
Well, doesn't it come back to the objectives? Because we actually did an episode about new trains with a former colleague of mine who's been involved in procuring them, Robin Davis, who you may know. And he was telling us about, I think the root cause of this is the utter obsession with just squeezing more seats Tony.
I raised it actually, because I said no transport minister would ever announce, I've authorised the purchase of new future trains that have 100 fewer seats. That every time, when we've seen it through 25-ish years of privatisation, every permission to order new trains has come with, and they will have
X more seats.
33 more seats per train or whatever.
But that's
and it's trapped itself in a cycle of squeezing them closer together and thinner and no luggage and everything.
But isn't that because of what we just said about what is the railway for?
Yeah, yeah.
Because nobody's answered that fundamental question of what you're trying to do. As soon as you answer that question more intellectually or just in a more sophisticated way of saying, well, actually, we're trying to move people who have luggage and bikes and pushchairs rather than just people.
I'd completely agree with that. But there's, you know, why can't we have both? I mean, we get so many either or in this situation. Mm. So, for example, just, you know, thinking out loud, sometimes you do get 10 coach pass 800s on the, or 801s, whatever, 80 whatever they are.
80X,
you know,
we'll go with, yeah.
Yes, well, yeah, 80X, yes. Because, yeah, you can't even say that anymore because then the East Midlands ones are going to be 8-1.
Oh, they're different trains. They're very different trains, so you'd leave them out. Sorry.
Okay, fair enough. So most of them are 9, some of them are 5 car. Why couldn't we have made them 10 car? And that 10th car could have been used for, say, proper buffet/restaurant, half of it, and the other half for luggage, bikes, whatever. Just as a for instance.
But we could have done. The point is we didn't. And so now we're in this place where the other thing politicians don't like doing and most people don't like doing is taking stuff away. So now that you've got it, you can't be seen to be the person who then turns half a carriage or a carriage into something other than seating because it's there now. And, you've sold the dream. It's the same as putting additional stations in, isn't it? Your station at Grove, you know, I hope you get it. And I hope they construct a proper timetable around it. Unlike examples closer to home that I've been involved in where they've built a new station with every logical intention of closing the other one down that's nearby because, you know, this one's in a better place, we've got new housing and all the things you were talking about. And then they don't bloody close the other one, they keep it open and we've got additional calls in the timetable. Who knew that was going to make the journey time longer because we have to slow down, we have to stop and then we have to speed up again. But nobody wants to be the person who says, oh, we've got to close this station down, even though it's the obvious thing to do, isn't it?
It is. And the thing is about a lot of these things is public buy-in, isn't it? In the Netherlands, the public accept, A, that some of their taxes will be used to pay for bits of a train that don't earn any money or not much money. And they accept that their taxes will be also used to fund other forms of transport or to support active travel. And this happens in other countries around. The Germans have regular local referenda to support continued local taxes being used to fund local transport of all sorts. And every year, enough of them, and by significant majorities, I'm told, vote to carry on paying those local taxes. We have a strangely different attitude here, don't we? A, we had a lot of political thing. How much is that seat earning? So if you start taking seats out, you're going to lose the earning power of the train. But also, probably, if you'd stood for election and said, I'm advocating an increase in income tax of 2%, but train fares will come down by 30%, you probably wouldn't be doing this interview now. Because there aren't enough people that would support that. But in other parts of Europe, that's fine. What a good idea.
Yes, I mean, but also it's partly, you know, Netherlands and Switzerland, they do have more successful economies in terms of, you know, GDP per capita is way higher than ours. So, you know, so some of that wider thing about needing to get the economy moving better as well as looking at taxation is important. But I think what you're describing with the, you know, the whole seats and the spreadsheets thing, I think there is a bit of excessive spreadsheet culture here. And I'm afraid that does come back to our friends in the Treasury.
Yeah.
I'm sure they're all lovely people. I know someone who works there and he's a lovely person. And I think there's that old expression, isn't there? What gets measured gets done.
Yeah.
But the problem with that is you've got to make sure you're measuring the right thing
in the first place. Yeah.
And there are some things that you can't necessarily measure in the sort of simple numerical and statistical way. And that is the value of the overall service offer. So, for example, if you're going from London to Penzance, and it was easy to have a meal on that train. I know there's 2 a day where they do it, but you've got to be in the right set of 5 cars and on the right train and be able to get an affordable advance purchase tickets on that right train, none of which I've ever managed to do. If you were able to have a meal on that journey, and it would be easy to take luggage, including surfboards, that's another retrograde step we've had with the new trains there, and you market that, then suddenly that is quite an attractive overall offer compared to having to drive of all of those things. You definitely can't have a meal on whilst you're driving. We shouldn't do anyways. It's very strong discouraged. Then you start to say, okay, so maybe we'll be able to make this product more attractive. We'll be able to get more people travelling, because it's not as if every seat is always filled at the moment, even off-peak times. So it's thinking about it in a broader way. And I was having a conversation with someone about capacity on cross-country. There's scepticism that if you were to give cross-country more trains or longer trains, that they would pay for themselves with additional revenue. But what would the marginal cost be of, say, let's imagine we had six cars rather than five cars? What is the marginal cost of that, given that you're paying for the tracks, you're paying for the signalling, you're paying for the drivers, you're paying for the train managers, you're paying for the fleet maintenance people? So, yeah, sure, let's imagine this person's right and it wouldn't necessarily pay for itself. But what's the overall increased cost, given that you're going to be paying for all of those things anyway by actually having a railway? Let's make the most of these assets, because let's be realistic. We're not going to rip them all up.
Yeah, we're not going to get rid of the railway, are we? So there's elements of it that are staying.
I'm sure some people would love to, but it's just not going to happen. And you think of something like, you know, Southampton to the West Midlands. Well, you don't just need that for cross country. You need that for intermodal freight. You need it for all the other passes. So you've got this thing that costs money. How can we make best use of that? And part of the answer is to be able to offer a more reliable, more comfortable alternative to the A34 and M40 corridors. For example, so it's thinking, it's having that bigger thinking, not just, well, what does the spreadsheet say? Because it's not just about that. Life isn't just one series of tactical engagements with spreadsheets. It's just not.
Thank goodness. I mean, that sounds like an awful existence if we were only interacting with spreadsheets, not cats and dogs and railway folk.
Some people get off on that. I mean, I would admit, I quite like a spreadsheet as well, actually.
But the problem has been the spreadsheet mentality has meant things like only two trains a day have a Pullman meal in each direction, because particularly since the National Rail contracts, catering has been lowered on the companies that offer catering, and past DFT, not current one, was saying to them, should you be providing it at all, really? Because they've read the history books, and the history books say catering on trains has never actually covered the cost of providing it. So the spreadsheet man says, well, don't do it then. The spreadsheet man doesn't look at, but it's tempting people onto the train.
I'm going to be controversial here and say I disagree with you boys, because I'm in the get rid of it camp. I'm in the world has changed. You know, you go to any railway station pretty much now, except for the diddly little, you know, northern ones with nothing there. You can get a better coffee, a better sandwich, a better provision of any kind of snack you want from any railway station than you'll ever be able to get on a train consistently. Because with the best will in the world, providing it consistently on a train is really difficult.
Well, they manage it. They manage it in Switzerland. They manage it in Austria. They manage it in Germany. I've used all of these restaurant cars, and they're really good. And you know what? They're often really well used, really full.
And I get that. I just don't think it's the top of the priority list at the minute. We've got bigger issues with our railway, and I think we should.
Well, there's always bigger issues.
Prioritise other things. Because we waste a lot of energy talking about lukewarm coffee on trains, whereas actually just buy a Costa or other brand of choice before you get on the train.
I don't drink coffee at all, and it's. Let me explain the value to me. I had a job in York for a couple of years, and I commuted every week from Didcot to York. Never used cross country because their timetable was completely useless for my purposes. Always went via London, and there were sometimes, if I'd had a busy day doing other things, there were sometimes it was ultra helpful to not have to leave more time to procure something between Paddington and King's Cross, but I'd just be able to get on that train and know I'd be able to just get something from the little buffet that they have. Nothing amazing, just something that would do the job. It saves a huge amount of time. And, you know, in a few weeks, I'm going from London to Aberdeen on a train. So, yeah, sure, I could get a sandwich before I went, but it's going to be so late by the time I get there, partly because of engineering work and diverting via Hexham, that am I really going to be able to get dinner at Aberdeen at 10 o'clock at night? Not that confident. So, you know, for those, I mean, you know, London to Bristol, fine, we can have a debate about that, whether you need it on there. But for those really long distance things, you know, where I was talking about, you know, 5.5 hours London to Penzance, 3 hours London to Swansea.
I'm with you on that. I agree.
But that's the problem, isn't it? We've thrown the baby out with the bath.
Completely. I was just going to say that.
I don't know whether the Liberal Democrats ever got anywhere with saying I agree with before the next person, but I agree with Ollie. Particularly on things like journeys to somewhere like Plymouth or Penzance, and I have enjoyed the Great Western Pullman several times. It is fantastic, and I recommend anyone to try it while it still exists, just in case the new era sees the end of it, but it's fantastic. And part of the thing is, as I've said on Radio 4, actually, what kind of restaurant can you go in where the scenery changes outside the window while you're dining and you're getting silver service and whatever, and one minute you're looking at the sea and the next minute the countryside? So it's part of the journey experience, that. So in the right place at the right time, is why the European operators still, many of them offer it, because it's part of the journey experience.
I mean, and Switzerland is interesting because, you know, some of the Austrian examples I've used, I have used all of these things, by the way, I'm not just lauding hypothetical things. The Austrian things are perhaps a bad example because they do tend to be very long journeys. Switzerland, they don't have it on every route. They have it on the sort of their main intercity routes. And honestly, the way they run it is incredible because I had two 55-minute stints doing a journey from sort of southern Switzerland to Zurich. And they have their own catering division on Swiss Railways. The service is just incredible. As soon as you've left the stop and everyone sat down, they come with a little tablet, which clearly shows where everyone sat at the table. They come through, ask you what you want. I think it's on Austrian Railways, they ask you where you're getting off just to sort out the whole payment thing. And then it all comes, like, dead quick. There were loads of people on there. The day I was doing this journey, it was on a Sunday, so you had loads of Swiss army people, like, travelling across the country, which I'm told is very common. And there was just loads of them in there, just having a little beer, some people having something to eat. That was my particular bit of that journey, was just 55 minutes. Probably the overall train just was 2 or 3 hours. So that shows you how it can work, even where there's sort of frequent stops and lots of things. You know, it's all part of having that offer of quality, of reliability, something that you can depend on. If you're going on a multi-hour journey, then you need it. And yeah, sure, there's other priorities, but we do too much of that in this country as well. We say because it's not a number one priority, then that means we can't do it. We are intelligent creatures, human beings. We can say that we've got 10 things we want to sort out, and we're going to dedicate 95% of our effort to the top nine. That doesn't mean that you can't do anything with the
Totally agree with you. And actually, yeah, perhaps I gave the impression I didn't want to do anything about it at all. I do want to, but I like the idea of prioritising it on the flows that would really benefit from it, where people would value it. And I love that you use the word dependable, because I actually think that the worst thing you can do is promise to deliver catering and then fail to. Yep. Either promise it and do it well, or, you know what, just let people know it's not available, because the worst thing you can do is get on, your example, King's Cross to Aberdeen. If you turn up for that train expecting to be able to get something to eat and drink and then they don't have anything on, well, that's even worse, because you're a prisoner then. You're stuck on the train to Aberdeen with no solution to your problem. At least if you'd known that there was no catering, you know, you're an intelligent human being. You can go via a shop en route and get something. But not having the information is the worst thing, isn't it? And just not being dependable is what, you know, I find frustrating.
Agree with that, and then that comes back to the wider question of reliability. How do we cope with disruption? How do we sort of maintain service levels? And yeah, I mean, on GWR, I'm no doubt going to not make Mark Hopwood by saying this, but the trolley service is often a sort of hypothetical concept. It doesn't tend to survive contact with disruption very well, or, you know, with thankfully I'm not a hot drinker, but so often you hear an announcement that, you know, the hot water's not working on the trolley or whatever. So, yeah. And I think that's often been the problem here, actually, with where we have tried to do catering. There's not been a real effort to take it seriously make it a really essential, high quality, reliable part of the offer. And then, surprisingly enough, then people start using it less and you get into a death spiral.
Of course, yeah.
We'll be coming to Mark Hopwood today because it's his birthday, but some of the stuff he's got that do provide it are fantastic. So that's the thing
that
as well.
Dependable, it's the dependable thing, isn't
yeah,
it?
You yeah. either get the service and they're fantastic and they're you know, really couldn't do more. But then there's that moment of disappointment.
We had one journey. Yeah. Did I tell you about them? Keith and I were working on the Western recently and had to put in some mileage, you know, getting all around what is a huge network. I mean, you know, it always fascinates me how Great Western works because it's massive in terms of just the mileage. And we were putting the miles in. And this one particular day, I think we were going from... we were definitely going all the way down to Plymouth. And I can't remember where from, but a really, really long journey. And it was the other extreme. We couldn't get rid of this trolley host. Yeah. Like, she must have come back every 10 minutes. And it was because it was quiet. And she, you know, wanted to give good service and wanted something to do. But it was almost embarrassing. It was like, I really can't have another cup of tea. You know, I'm going to like...
Perhaps there's probably pictures of you up in the catering area, though. And it says, if you see this person, be nice to them. Signed, Mark.
But, it's usually my face on a dartboard in a mess room, Tony. I don't think it's a be nice to her.
I was going to say, by the way, that because we've talked about Europe a little bit, and obviously there are things that Europe has said it could learn from us. It thinks we do yield management better and fill more seats and stuff. I'm also told that the Swiss have a big maintenance backlog that they need to address, and they're kind of pretending it's not there. So they might have to uncover some of their hidden gold and invest in some of those fantastic bridges over gorges and things like that. So there's always a danger in, as we've been saying in previous things, taking your eye off the ball just for a moment because everything's running well. And even if we get our railway back to some semblance of being brilliant, we don't want another of Maggie Thatcher's maintenance holidays or anything like that. We have to keep on top of it and keep it brilliant and reliable.
Mm. Can we just talk about life on the railway for a minute, Ollie? Can we reminisce for a minute? Because it's just nice to do that sometimes, isn't it? And talk about your time, our time together, following each other around Network Rail and various bits of train operating land. Well, just let's make Tony laugh for a minute, actually, about us young pups. We were on the same grad scheme, weren't we, together a long time ago?
We were. Yes, started in September 2006.
Yeah, which feels like a lifetime ago in many ways. But we were talking to Roger Ford, and he was a little bit, I guess, wistful and woeful in some ways about the lack of joined up kind of railway management nowadays, because I think we were a Network Rail graduate scheme, and clearly a new generation of graduate trainees, along with our TOC colleagues, different to, you know, the sort of the BR grads who did a very joined up training scheme. And you and I worked for Network Rail and then went on to work for other bits, as we call it, of the railway. But there's not all that many people like us, really, are there, of our generation?
And I think it's a real problem, because it's a real problem for several reasons. That firstly, one, the infrastructure side can't focus without the train operation side. That's just a fact. So only really knowing or understanding one of the other is problematic. Secondly, there's so much mutual suspicion between the two sides, even now, you know, West and East Berlin, in some ways. And I think a really good way of countering that is actually to work for both, because I don't know what your view is, Anna-Jane. I would say that they're, for all the differences, they're remarkably similar. I think, you know, maybe 10 years ago there was a bit of difference because, you know, in theory, some train operators did have some vaguely commercial features. I can't imagine many of them do now, apart from, you know, the open access ones. But culturally, I always felt that they were quite similar. It might be, I never worked on, I'm probably going to get in trouble for saying this, I never worked on any sexy talks. Do you know what I mean? I didn't work on any sort of snazzy, super duper, intercity glamorous ones. I just worked on this, you know, some of the quite big ones that just had to feed the customers into those sexy talks, you know, London, Midland and Southern.
And I think that's probably why your observation is true, that why you would have seen so many similarities is, I do recognise that in the main, that railway folk are railway folk. And in my time on the railway, more than anything, the similarity that exists is that the vast, vast majority of people, and I probably sound boring because I say this, you know, in nearly every debate we get into, the vast majority of railway folk just want to get out of bed, go to work and do a good job to run the railway better than, you know, than it's being run now, or as best they can. The amount of people who I've ever met who are slavishly commercial, mercenary, or want anything bad for the railway is a tiny, tiny minority of people, or, you know, almost negligible, in fact, which I think is probably what you're describing, that the culture in that sense is so similar on both sides.
Yes, but I did mean it positively, but I also meant it negatively, in the sense that
go on.
Bureaucracy, red tape,
slow to change,
an aversion to doing things differently,
not invented here.
And you know, Network Rail's got, you know, one hand tied behind its back for all sorts of reasons, you know, control periods, settlements, governance rules, you know, what Department for Transport, Treasury, masters and mistresses. I mean, the train operators have a lot of that as well, whether that's, you know, highly prescriptive franchise or now management contract agreements. I mean, I said this when I spoke in Parliament. The key problem of when I was at London Midland, I was there for nearly 4 years in the end. We were always in the last year of the franchise, even though I was there for nearly 4 years. And it just prevented so many things being done because people were like, well, there's either no point doing that or we're not allowed to do that because we're in the last year of the franchise.
Like, and you just reminded me, well done for getting a Star Trek reference into your maiden speech in Parliament, because that was how you described it, wasn't it? That you felt like you were in some sort of, was it Star Trek or Star Wars? I always get them confused.
Never Star Wars with me. Oh, no.
I thought that. I'm sure you're Trek, not Wars, but I just...
very much so. Very much so. In the same way, I'm cat, not dog. I managed to work a Star Trek reference into both speeches so far. I'll have to stop doing it.
I think you should continue. It can be your thing.
One doesn't want to be a one-trick pony. But yes, it was like, you know, some of the best Star Trek episodes is where they're just stuck in this time loop and they just can't get out of it. And it was like that because we were always in the last year of the franchise and yet nearly 4 years of time had elapsed. And you just kind of think, well, that doesn't make sense. That defies the logic of the space-time continuum. And yet that is what happened when we were there. So.
That feels in Great Western.
I'm going to have to do some challenging. I once did a challenge with a boring afternoon with Five Lives travel reporter where I gave her a word to get into every travel report for the whole afternoon. So every 20 minutes, we got more and more bizarre words somehow worked in. So I think the challenges are there. Everyone's celebrating this week that the announcement that finally Cross Country is going to be allowed to refurbish its trains, which since 2004 or something, it's being told, oh, that's for the next operator. That's for the next operator. And you look at it, and I saw one the other day, and it's got so many little patches of silver paint on it. And you think, how could successive ministers have said, we don't want to agree to it yet, that's for someone else.
Mm.
And it's an embarrassment to visitors that are coming into our country, they get on Cross Country or whatever. It's an embarrassment to passengers. And it's been this constant, it's going to be for someone else to decide in a year's time. Mm. We can't have that in our railways, that short-term locking of things.
You know, here's an idea. It sounds incredibly obvious saying out loud. I mean, why isn't that even just sort of... No, given we apparently have to have rolling stock leasing, and no one can ever quite explain to me why we have to have it. How about this? Work out based on the expected use of the train after how many, you know, 1,000 miles of operation you would want to have a midlife refurbishment. Actually sort of define it at that point as a marker, maybe even build the financing into it, because you know you're going to want to do it at some point.
It has been on some, and on others, that was the irony that Virgin had two contracts. The Pendolinos had a midlife contract that couldn't be got out of, which is why they got painted white.
Yeah,
because Alstom said it's in the contract, government.
So it has been done. It's just not consistent.
Bombardier never put it in with the Voyagers, so they couldn't. But in DfT desperately trying to get out of painting the Pendolinos because it said, oh, that's for the future operator. And Alstom just said, contract guys, what colour do you want it? It's not a question of not. It's only you pick the colour.
I feel like you're going to see another similarity, Ollie, that it was interesting that you said you saw similarities between the culture at Network Rail and the talks in terms of that constraint of time. Surely it's going to be the same in Parliament because, you know, the whole 5-year Parliament, is it going to be the same that you're ramping up after being elected as government, you then do some stuff in the middle? So how much progress will we really make with rail reform in, say, I don't know, what do you reckon, 2-3 years by the time actually things get ramped up, then we do some stuff. And then will all attention in year 4 turn to the next general election? How soon will that, you know, the focus shift to the next big push to get re-elected? You maybe don't know yet because you're new to this, but I just wonder what your perception is.
I think I've got a flavour. I mean, I'm perhaps going to be a classic Lib Dem here and now argue against myself because, you know, because we supported and we still support a fixed-term Parliament Act, because the problem is at the moment we don't know when the next election is going to be. Keir Starmer could call one tomorrow if he wanted. Can't imagine he will.
Yeah.
But, you know, we don't know. And I actually think having that confidence saying the next election will be on this date unless there's, you know, this set of exceptional circumstances, that would be helpful. And not just for us candidates and all the tens of thousands of people who work or volunteer in politics, because this year has been a complete nightmare trying to plan anything. Everyone thought it was going to be October, really. I mean, nobody believed it would be called in late.
Yeah.
Not even like the elite of the Lib Dem political strategy gurus saw that one. So actually, I think politics would be helpful if the government knew how long it had, and then they could just focus on making the most of that time. But that's one of the good things I think that they've done, actually, by, and I did say this in my speech, the fact they have brought some legislation forward about rail very early, even if I think the state versus private thing is not going to fix very many problems, it's still good that they're giving it focus, because I mean, that's how I described it in the speech. It's a bit of a Cinderella topic.
Yeah.
No one wants to talk about transport, no one wants to talk about railways. It's often neglected, so it's good that they've made that an early priority.
And the two things, I suppose we talked about this earlier, is being careful not to rush just for the point of getting it done, which takes us back to John Major's privatisation, where the rail experts, Chris Green, will tell you the story of people sitting in the room with him saying, just don't do it in this stupid way. Because at one point he wanted to recreate the Big Four. And they said, the Big Four don't exist. Some of their tracks have gone and things. Really? Have they? But there was that desperate thing to get it done before an election, which made mistakes. And sadly, and don't commit your life to it to such an extent, as we know, and historians record, that late Robert Adley, Conservative MP, who thought Major had got it completely wrong, fought it so hard to try and get the Railway Privatisation Act right and to get some things in, ultimately died it is believed, because he just completely stressed himself out and wore his body out fighting, because as a railway man, he knew some things were being done the wrong way. So whilst we, you know, we welcome you to Parliament and your commitment to support the rail industry, just remember there's life outside as well for you, please.
There's a cheerful thought.
No, seriously, because poor Robert, yes. You know, he was a lone voice, and you read the accounts of how he tried to fight against some of the madness, you know.
Shall we ask our questions?
Yes.
We have three light-hearted questions that we ask of all our guests, Ollie. And when our guest is a member of the railway family, which they aren't always, but when our guests are, we ask them three questions rather than two. So, sorry, you've got an extra one.
Right, anywhere in the world, what is your favourite railway journey?
Oh, my goodness me.
You've been on so many, Ollie. I feel like we're bound to go abroad.
Can I come back to that one?
Yep. Okay. So, whilst you're making these journeys all around the world, what is your favourite railway station?
Oh, do I have to come back to that one as well? Well, what's the third one?
The third one is, more for my asking than Tony's, what has been your favourite railway job?
Oh, okay. That one I can do. And it was actually my first proper job after, well, properish. We come off gradually working for Joe Kay, actually, as you mentioned earlier, who was a great gaffer. Very, very demanding. But so you should be, but in a very sort of supportive and encouraging way. So I was the most junior member of her perfectly formed team of six people. And we were created as an extra team working on the final phases of West Coast Route Modernisation.
Yeah, I remember this.
And our mission was to work across the industry to get everyone ready for that December 2008 timetable change. Mm. So I had some sort of project management responsibilities, but we were mostly troubleshooters. We were just going off to solve these little bits of the thing that weren't working. And I really liked that job because there was a clear mission, there was a clear deadline, but I also had the sort of the freedom to operate and do things in the way that I wanted. And actually, there was enormous predictions of doom and disaster and utter calamity around that timetable. And I remember on day four, we managed to get 100% AM peak performance into Euston, and the core structure of that timetable is still with us today. So you know that's having worked on something very tangible that did deliver huge benefits for passengers and freight to a slightly lesser extent.
Oh, it was a great time that was that I was working on the cross country account on the December 08 timetable as well at the same time, and there was loads of great, you know, when people romanticise about, you know, oh, well, when I worked with Chris Green and all these big names that they say, like, I think for us, that era, for me anyway, was the time of the people that I think of as our kind of generation of, well, probably a bit older than us, actually, people like my husband, and like they had proper jobs, whereas Ollie and I were just in our sort of first jobs, as he says, and we were sort of looking up to them, and then above them, people like Joe, because that must have made a difference. Having a great boss like Joe was a massive part of why you enjoyed that job, like, because you've got a leader that you're looking up to.
But sorry. It was a great era to be writing about it as well, because every time you went in to interview anyone, they were really excited and there were smiles and there was optimism. And, you know, I can remember several meetings with Chris Green and the team at Euston, and just, we're bringing this on, this is happening stuff.
We're also going from a low benchmark in some ways, because there was some pretty shit performance as well. I remember having daily sub 80% PPM conferences a lot around that time. Anyway,
are we back on the other two yet?
It's not necessarily my favourite. I'm just going to tell you about just one that sort of has come to mind whilst I've been talking. I tell you what, I enjoyed doing Hamburg to Copenhagen, actually. There's lots of interesting things along that. You've got this amazing bit of railway that doubles back on itself in this German town called Rendsburg, I think it is, or Flensburg, I forget which, because the railway has to go over this enormous ship canal and then loop back round in itself just to lose the gradient to get back to the generally very flat bit of the landscape. That's spectacular. And then when you're in Denmark, going across the, I've forgotten the name of the bridge, but they built this combined road and rail bridge to eliminate ferries from shipping from the main island that's got Copenhagen with everything else. That was just fantastic on this very hot summer evening, just looking at sort of the pinks and blues of the evening sky.
Oh, lovely.
I definitely remember that. And a station... Bloody hard questions, as I tell you. I do like a lot of the big German ones, actually, because they do, like Frankfurt Hauptbahnhof, for example, they do have good amenities. There's with so many, I can't even remember how many platforms it's got. I mean,
and they like a big station in Germany, don't they? Mm-hmm. Like a big station.
They do. You still always end up waiting for a platform, though. But, you know, that's probably got, it must have, what, about 25 surface platforms and then four underground for the S-Bahn or something like that. But They have other nice things at German stations. They have really good amenities. There's a really interesting food court at, maybe that's Hamburg Hauptbahnhof, actually, where there's all sorts of interesting stuff you can get, and yet they still have
great onboard catering. I knew you were going to say that.
Well, not always great, because a lot of the time the fridges aren't working on ICEs, or a lot of the time the staff can't be bothered either. It's my experience. So Germany, you will notice when we were talking about on-train catering, I didn't talk about Germany very much. Okay. I talked about Switzerland and Austria, where I've only ever had good experiences. They often have these nice little coin-operated model railways in a glass case at big German railway stations, which are a very pleasant little diversion. I've never seen anything like that any of ours. So in the case Andrew Haynes is watching this, is because I would put that idea forward for Network Rail major stations.
Maybe replace some of the pianos that they've got in major stations with a coin-operated model railway.
I would very much support that, because at the risk of sounding like a killjoy, a lot of the time, to be honest, people who play those pianos are just noise pollution. Anyway.
So thanks, Ollie, so much for joining us. I knew that would be an enjoyable conversation, and frankly, we could have chatted for hours and probably even longer if we had a glass of something convivial to enjoy, which is normally how I enjoy my conversations with you over the years, and we'll have to do that soon. So thank you for joining us on Parallel Lines.
As ever, if you've got feedback on what you've heard, or you'd like us to find more politicians to talk to, or get Ollie back to ask him some deeper and more complicated questions about the railways or anything else, then the contact, we've been practicing this so much, the contact email is
contact@pwllines.com.
There we go. That's the first time we've got it right, first take. So,
I had to close my eyes to get it right. I was concentrating so hard.
Thank you very much. Thank you for joining us, Ollie. It's been really interesting talking to you. Thank you for your time.
And keep in touch, because I know you're just super busy now, but genuinely, I wish you all the best. And I'm watching and listening on Radio 4, usually, late at night, and listening to what you've been doing. So, and keep posting on Facebook. I love the updates and seeing how you're getting on.
Very kind.